Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, the protection of our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, is getting more challenging by the day because, I would argue, enemies domestic are amping up dramatically the political warfare and worse that they are waging against the rest of us. A man who has studied these matters closely over a lifetime of distinguished service to our country, in government and out, notably from the perspective of somebody deeply immersed in political matters, campaigns, and the like, and who is now commenting on them brilliantly as the editor-in-chief of the Richard Viguerie newsletter, known as Conservative HQ, is our first guest. Regular here at Securing America, as I'm fond of saying, our duty genius. He is a Mensa Society member and a fabulous friend. George Raceley is his name. George, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So much to talk with you about. Let's quickly take stock of the piece of all of this political stuff that is of greatest concern to me at the moment, and that is the political warfare that is now being more and more and more relentlessly and it seems without limitation waged against people who the Biden administration considers to be its adversaries. A prime example of all of this is, of course, Donald Trump and the weaponization of the Department of Justice and the FBI and the judicial branch and so on against him. Give us your read on the state of the play with respect to these indictments, including the most recent one about January 6th.
Well, I don't think our country has been in this kind of internal jeopardy since the period right before the Civil War. The Biden administration, I would argue Joe Biden himself, if he's not non-compos, and certainly his inner circle, have deployed the U.S. government against their political adversaries. This has not been seen in our lifetimes, Frank. It was done, believe it or not, by Democrats in the period around the First World War, when Woodrow Wilson deployed the Espionage Sedition Act and various other laws that were later questioned, if not found completely unconstitutional, against his adversaries. He locked up the socialist candidate for president, Eugene V. Debs. It got so bad that 25 or 6, Wisconsin farmers were indicted for protesting the war as being a capitalist enterprise. And this is, swiftly heading downhill. And as Trump is fond of saying, they're not after me, I'm just in the way, they're after you. And so, you and I are the 25 Wisconsin farmers who are next on the list.
And many, many besides us, that's for sure. Yeah. So George, when you look at these indictments, and you've had legal training, I know, does the case that's been made, let's just focus on the most recent one, this idea that Donald Trump was involved in all kinds of conspiracies, basically aimed at overthrowing the government of the United States in connection with January 6th, a narrative that we're going to talk a little bit more about on the other side of this particular question. But how does this look to you? Is this grasping at straws by the special prosecutor, or is there any merit to the case?
No, absolutely. I mean, first of all, every one of us has an absolute right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And yeah, that's in the First Amendment. And So criminalizing Trump's challenge to the election is completely contrary to the First Amendment. Secondly, Congress is the finder of fact in all matters related to those Electoral College votes. And that's what they were doing on January 6th. So the executive branch cannot ex post facto declare that a petition to Congress, a separate branch of government, is is illegal or a crime. I mean, it's just outrageous how far beyond any kind of constitutional norms this has gone.
Yeah, it's free speech, it's freedom of assembly, it's freedom of petitioning for grievances. I mean, it's a frontal assault, it seems to me, on the Constitution. And it brings me to a related matter. Earlier this week, Rahim Kassam of the National Pulse brought forward a fascinating clip from apparently an hour-long interview that Tucker Carlson conducted with the man who was the chief of the Capitol Police at the time of January 6th, a fellow by the name of Stephen Sund. And in the course of that interview, the clip that we've seen so far at least, it's pretty clear that this guy, who you would have thought was at the very tip of the spear of protecting the Capitol in the event of something bad going down on that day, had been denied access to the intelligence about what was coming, had been denied the ability to summon help from the National Guard when things started going bad, and came away from it all seemingly at least suspicious, if not persuaded, that what was going on was according to a plan. Not an above board plan, but one that produced the desired results for those who were conducting it, and that was then covered up afterwards. Based on what we know, apart from this video, does that sound right to you?
Absolutely right. I mean, there's a vast mountain of evidence that the people who should have been preparing for this event were studiously ignoring all of the warning signs. And there were vast numbers. I mean, it's, and the FBI and other, you know, alphabet agencies have absolutely categorically refused to quantify how many of their agents, operatives, confidential human sources were actually out there January 6th.
And I'm not sure they've even acknowledged that they had them out there, have they? I haven't heard that.
Good.
They haven't denied that they did, that's for sure, but have they acknowledged it?
At any rate, the evidence is clear that someone had a plan, and it wasn't a plan to defend the Capitol, to manage the crowd, or anything else. And I mean, it's just, you know, having been involved in several inaugural planning events, I mean, it's just, it boggles my mind that the resources were not there to protect the site of the inauguration, to protect the Capitol.
Worse even than that, George, they didn't have the standard business as usual level of security, evidently. They had a lower level, and I think that probably was not known by the chief of police at the time.
Well, but it was.
We're going to have to come back. George, stand by. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more with George Raceley of Conservative HQ, a must-read news medium and outlet. We'll be right back. This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. So, now we have an answer to the question that has dogged the Biden presidency since its inception. who's actually in charge. According to a fascinating interview with Barack Obama's official biographer in Tablet magazine, he is. This shouldn't come as a surprise. After all, Obama publicly declared he wanted such an arrangement. His former staffers run the current White House and administration, and his promised fundamental transformation of America has accelerated dramatically. For example, Obama-Biden 3.0 has reportedly secretly agreed to an informal deal that gives another $20 billion to Iran. It's preparing to cede U.S. sovereignty to the UN and World Health Organization in the name of global governance, and it hopes to finish off the takedown of the American military by making its top officer a favored, race-obsessed, cultural Marxist general. Question: could Barack Obama be the big guy? This is Frank Afton.
We're back, and we're continuing this very important conversation with George Raisley about, among other things, the political warfare being waged against American patriots, including Donald Trump. And George, I just want to complete that thought about this idea that there was a plan. It wasn't, you know, an above board plan. It seems to me, and I'd welcome your thoughts on this, that there's enough evidence of this. There's enough smoke, as they say, that we need to see Nancy Pelosi, who apparently was given access to all of that intelligence, who apparently was involved in making the call that the National Guard would not be brought to bear. And in other ways, I think probably was also responsible for lowering the security readiness of the police that day. What was her role in all of this? Well, what did she know? What did she do?
Yeah, well, she is clearly the nexus of all of this. And she's never been required to answer any of the hard questions. And I think that she should be. And certainly, with the Republicans running the House, they ought to take that opportunity. You know,
by a subpoena if necessary and under oath, I think is absolutely required. And not least because if the chief of police, the Capitol Police, is right, that not only was there a plan, but there was a cover-up of that plan, she was at the railhead of that too. There's no question about that. George, let me pivot from that to a related, in a way, problem, and that is the cultural Marxist efforts to take down our country well beyond, you know, silencing, marginalizing, imprisoning their political opponents. There is a general officer, currently the chief of staff of the Air Force, who has been nominated to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His name is General C.Q. Brown. You've written about him quite critically, and properly so, I think, at Conservative HQ. The Senate of the United States, which must confirm this nomination, failed to do so before it left town for 6 weeks of recess. This seems to me to be a very important, indeed providential, opportunity to engage the American people on the inadvisability of entrusting a man who does seem deeply committed to cultural Marxism in the military to become the next top military officer of our country. Give us your read on this, and especially how it bears on a very fraught circumstance with China at the moment.
Well, I don't know how General Brown can swear to uphold the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, when the Supreme Court has said, in essence, how he's running the Air Force is unconstitutional. I mean, the recent...
Not in quite so many words, but that was the thrust of their recent decision on
the
affirmative action.
Decision in the Harvard case was four square on the issues of how Brown has running the Air Force and how he has openly said that's how he would run the entire military as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And this is, I mean, you know, I can't describe in words of, you know, that don't involve four letters, how bad an idea that
is. Thank you for not doing it on this program. It's appreciated.
Yeah. I mean, the recruitment is down, and it's down for a reason, because the patriotic young Americans who would not benefit from Brown's, you know, race-based ideas of promotion and training and everything else are saying, why would I subject myself to this and, you know, risk getting shot too? So, you know, I mean, it's just been a disaster for the military, and Brown would make it worse.
Well, and specifically the Air Force, as you have pointed out, I think, in one of your pieces, the Heritage Foundation's Index of U.S. Military Strength has said that in the course of his tenure as the top Air Force officer, that service, in terms of its military strength, has gone from marginal to weak to very weak in three successive years. This is not something we want done to the entire United States military, that's for sure. And you know, I have a colleague, a very admired and highly respected colleague, who shared with me the other day that there's a lot of fulmination inside the services about the problems they're having recruiting people. But as they look at the factors that are causing it, they have deliberately excluded the possibility that it might have anything to do with this cultural Marxist agenda. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And again, George, we've talked about this a lot. You're a member of our Committee on the Present Danger. China, you know very well. We're not just dealing with, you know, naval officers or personnel who've been spying for China. We're not just dealing with a Chinese biological warfare laboratory. I mean, these are recent stories that are all further evidence that we've got a problem, Houston. But we're talking about a China that may well be at the cusp of taking us to the old-fashioned kind of war, a shooting war. How, just quickly, how would the current condition of the military and the possibility that it could be greatly exacerbated were C.Q. Brown to become the chairman.
I mean,
impact that our ability to, well, maybe not just to deter a war, but to fight and win it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually the worst part of Brown's record, is that a dozen of the aircraft that would be crucial to fighting and winning a war with Red China are at some of their lowest levels of operational readiness in decades.
You mean types of aircraft, not just individual aircraft?
No, the entire fleets of our attack aircraft, our transport aircraft are running, you know, 50-60% operational, and that is a recipe for defeat.
Yeah, and George, I mean, look, set aside for the moment the idea that this guy actually thinks that, you know, critical race theory has to be indoctrinated into our armed forces, that that you want to have transgenders, you know, all over the place and make accommodations to them, even at the risk of the safety of service women, for example, who are having them showering and bunking with them. To say nothing, George, of the idea that we're displacing the whole notion of a meritocracy with quotas. But put all that aside, just on the basis of the performance on recruitment, on, you know, readiness, and on modernization. I somebody told me the other day that we're spending as much on investment in the next generation of aircraft as we are in maintaining the current ones, which means that we are not having as ready as we need the current forces. And a lot of money is going to be perhaps squandered down the road. The point is, those would seem to be disqualifiers for consideration for promotion all by themselves, let alone with this overlay of cultural Marxism.
Well, that's the thing, Frank. I mean, by any metric, Brown has failed as Air Force Chief of Staff. I take that back. The only metric that he might be succeeding at is all of this cultural Marxist stuff. By any metric of performance in the core mission, which is to defend the United States, he's failed.
Yeah, and I think that's how he got the gig to be chairman. Absolutely. As a matter of fact. George, we have to leave it at that. Thank you, my friend, for the great work you do at Conservative HQ. Keep
Thanks
it up.
For having
Come back,
back
to
Frank.
Us again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm pleased to welcome my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our Mideast program. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He is a man of considerable accomplishment in government, as well as in the private sector. He has been a naval intelligence officer, an advisor to the National Security Advisor, an Undersecretary of State, the Vice President of the United States. All of whom have, I think, benefited from his very wise counsel and deep understanding of the various challenges that this country faces in the Middle East, as well as its friends and allies in the region, notably, of course, our most important one, and that would be the State of Israel. David Wormser, it's good to have you back. Welcome once again.
Great to have you. I mean, great to be with you. Sorry.
Good. Let me start by asking you about reports that the United States government has decided to help two of its friends there, the State of Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, forge some sort of entente akin, I guess, to the Abraham Accords of the Trump administration. This has not been evident to this point, let me say, though they may pay lip service to it. But what's the ground truth as you see it? Is the administration being helpful in this regard at the moment?
No, I mean, the bottom line is they're not being helpful. And I think that at first their intervention was an attempt to sabotage it and to prove that the Trump administration and the Abraham Accords were a fraud and weren't real peace. They kept making that point, and they needed to prove it. So about a year and a half ago, under the previous Israeli government, when there was a summit of the various actors in the Abraham Accords and some that were not yet quite joined, the Americans forced themselves in and then tried to hijack it and refocus it back on the Oslo process, namely the Palestinian track, and involve the Palestinians in everything. And that was really for two points. One is to derail it all and show that the Abraham Accords weren't working. And second of all, to say that what they said even when the Abraham Accords were signed, whether it was Kerry or others, which is that's not really peace. There's because the Palestinians are not signing on. So at first it was an attempt, I think, to outright sabotage it and validate their interpretation that the Abraham Accords were not an accomplishment. Then the Saudis and the Israelis said, fine, I mean, we're just going to work under the table and coordinate alone And then the United States began to lose control of the situation. So in typical State Department fashion, when you lose control of policy, you try to co-opt the direction it's going and reclaim the pen on the policy document. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to reassert themselves as the controller of the policy. But two things. They obviously, for this election year, want to show they did the crown jewel of peace, which is Saudi Arabia. So they surpassed even Trump and delivered the real peace. And second of all, they want to validate that their interpretation that real peace only comes through the Palestinian track as well is true. So now they do want peace, but they want to do it on their terms to validate their political position. And the problem with that is that's not going to lead to peace. The second thing is the Saudis. The Saudis themselves want to work with Israel. I think they're moving toward peace, but they haven't forgiven this administration, the Biden administration, for trying to literally oust the Saudi monarchy, to bring it down. They were extremely hostile to them at the beginning of this administration, the Biden administration. I don't think the Saudis want to give the Biden administration a prize. So I think this is moving very fast between Israelis and Saudis, but it won't culminate in a formal peace until after this administration here is out of
interesting office. So what you've described, which just makes your head hurt, is a U.S. government that has been hostile to both of our most important regional allies, I think it's fair to say, and has been working against both of them, notably the Benjamin Netanyahu administration in Israel, and of course the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, and is now trying to muck up, having been unable to completely derail it, now involve itself in and still muck up a bipartisan, bipolar, by nations, I guess, effort to come to some sort of understanding, whether it's formalized as a peace accord or otherwise, that may contribute materially to our security interests in the region and certainly stability there. Just another example, unfortunately, of what I generally characterize as the wrecking operation of this administration. Let me ask you, David, as you see it, is that the other element of it was that they were apparently, in the efforts that the administration was making, trying to coerce the Israelis into going along with some sort of further concessions with the Palestinians as a price of getting this deal with the Saudis. Where do you think that stands? If the Saudis and the Israelis are moving forward, is that a feature of it or not?
Well, I don't think the Saudis really want too much movement on the path. What they really want out of Israel is to be a powerful country that they can align with in order to achieve a greater degree of security. They see their
interest. That is to say, they want the Israelis to be a powerful country they can align with.
They don't really care that much about the Palestinians and are more or less fed up with them, but they can't publicly break with their own past and side against the Palestinians with Israel. So publicly, the more this is public, the more the administration tries to make this a great festival, the more the Saudis have to fall back on rhetoric. And that sabotages it. So I think that these are really killer efforts rather than contributing efforts to the peace at this point. And it also, the administration, I'm not sure his heart is really in it, because while they do want that South Lawn ceremony to show we did what the former administration couldn't do, at the same time, it eats them to give Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, a victory.
Yeah, or for that matter, probably the Saudis, with whom they've been at odds. Again, it's I think a nadir for American diplomacy in the Middle East, and that's saying something, as we've had so many of them over the years. Let me turn to the domestic situation in Israel quickly with you, David. We have been tracking for some time now, particularly since Benjamin Netanyahu got a mandate in the elections of last November to reform the judiciary of Israel. how that has been progressing. Catch us up on the latest developments in that regard.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because it shows two things. One is the illiberalness of the left, and two, this is a dry run or a prototype for what will happen in America. What has happened is it's very clear now. This was never about the legal reform. It was an attempt to, through extra parliamentary ways, through basically street demonstrations and forcefulness, to bring down the elected government of Israel. And that was exposed because the government of Israel did back off on the reform, paused it for several months, and then came back with its most weak element that is a matter of consensus in some of the negotiations, and actually forwarded a proposal that was put forward a few years ago by the main opposition party for reducing the use of this reasonability doctrine in the courts, which is that the courts can basically say any law or any policy is reasonable or unreasonable without giving a rationale as to why it should be struck down. So it's basically a catch-all way for the court to strike down anything it doesn't like, from policies to laws. And this contracted their ability to do that. Very minor correction. And that's all that's left of the reform. And even so, the demonstrations continue. But now we're beginning to get a lot of stuff coming out about, first of all, the planning for this is 2 to 3 years old for the eventuality of a Netanyahu or right-wing government in Israel being elected. There's definitely a messianic coup d'etat type quality to Ehud Barak, the leader of the really emerging leader of this protest movement.
Former prime minister, former chief of the Israel Defense Forces.
And now the mechanisms are beginning to be exposed. For example, the latest was meetings hosted by a university president trying to organize all the companies that they had taken over, the protest movement had taken over through CEOs, to boycott the Fox News of Israel, Channel 14, the only conservative TV station, to shut it down. So they've now stripped it of its advertising revenue. And they're trying to do it as well with radios. And now one of the main research institutes in Israel, Kohelet, just lost its main funder because of pressure. So now they're trying to use the weight of their power, of economic power, over companies to bring down any structure that still survives on the right. And then they're...
And in particular, with a view to suppressing...
debate.
Information flows to the public and, as you say, to debate.
This is a Gramsci / Bolshevik. I mean, there's no other word for it. This is a Bolshevik attempt to silence any alternative voice.
That started with the problem that you and Carolyn Glick have identified with us in the past, with the loss of political support for the left that resulted in them being unable democratically through the electoral process to continue to exercise power. David, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is such an important story, especially the point you started with, which is this is a foretaste of what the left in the United States has in mind for us as well. So it's not just our commitment to Israel that's on the line here. It's our own future. Thank you, my friend, and keep up the great work that you do at our Center for Security Policy. God bless. We'll talk with you soon. We'll talk with the rest of you next time. Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm off by a block. David Wormser, thank you so much for the work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy, for your leadership on the Middle East project there, as well as so much more that you bring to this program and elsewhere. I know you'll keep it up, and we'll talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. So now we have an answer to the question that has dogged the Biden presidency since its inception. Who's actually in charge? According to a fascinating interview with Barack Obama's official biographer in Tablet magazine, he is. This shouldn't come as a surprise. After all, Obama publicly declared he wanted such an arrangement. His former staffers run the current White House and administration, and his promised fundamental transformation of America has accelerated dramatically. For example, Obama-Biden 3.0 has reportedly secretly agreed to an informal deal that gives another $20 billion to Iran. It's preparing to cede U.S. sovereignty to the UN and World Health Organization in the name of global governance, and it hopes to finish off the takedown of the American military by making its top officer a favored race-obsessed cultural Marxist general. Question: could Barack Obama be the big guy? This is Frank Afton. Welcome back, and a special welcome to a guest who we are proud to feature about this time each week. His name is Robert Charles, a man of considerable experience and extended service to our country, notably as a naval intelligence officer, as a clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as a senior member of the staff of the House of Representatives with oversight and investigation responsibilities, and not least, most recently, as the Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the George W. Bush administration. Robert Charles is his name, as I said, and he is a very valuable contributor to this program, a member of our committee on the present danger.
Frank, it's always an honor to be with you and to talk about the state of our unfortunately heavily vexed world.
Indeed, and country at that, for that matter. Speaking of vexed, as a former naval intelligence officer, I'm sure it is vexing to you to hear about naval personnel allegedly selling out their country to the Chinese communists. What can you tell us about what we know in the latest incident in this regard?
Yeah. Well, as you know, Frank, I'm not read in at the moment to anything that's classified, but I will tell you what, from what I've read, several thoughts immediately come to mind. The first thought is that this was going on apparently in one of the two cases for 2 years and in another case for a year. So that tells us that we are not paying attention to the ball. We have situations occurring which are obviously preventable. Counter-espionage, counterintelligence is an important part of what people are trained in, both around you and from the top down and the bottom up. And so counterintelligence is obviously weakened right now. And what does that mean? It probably reflects that there's a weakened readiness because our priorities are over on wokeness. God forbid we should get this fellow C.Q. Brown in, who's Mr. Woke himself. That would be a pretty heinous turn. It would sort of complete the turn as a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But I think what we're looking at, Frank, is a breakdown in the system, number one. Number two, we're looking at a recognition, or I hope we're recognizing in this, that China is targeting military personnel. They are seeking to penetrate our Pentagon. They have penetrated our society at the civil level, on the civil side. They have, if you look at, and I read the Financial Times as well as the Wall Street Journal, a bunch of other places, bottom line is if you look at the financial flows right now, people are leaving China rapidly. Investment is falling dramatically. You know, our economy is, of course, in trouble because of Biden, but their economy is also in trouble, which is only to say that they're looking to penetrate our military and get every advantage they can. And the third thing I'm going to say is let's look at this and wonder what was going on in the minds of those two enlisted personnel. They see their chief executive, they see the commander in chief taking tens of millions of dollars, lying about it from China, lying about it, never mind from Ukraine and Romania, lying about it. They see, if they're attentive, documents coming out of Treasury and DOJ and FBI, as well as whistleblowers saying, yep, he did all this and we're not going to do anything about it. And, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, things roll downhill. And when the commander in chief is on the take with China, then you get enlisted officers, I'm sure, who say to themselves, well, if he's doing it, why can't I do it? And unfortunately, that's a horrific turn of events.
Right. Well, it's not just enlisted personnel. Of course, it's people all throughout the government. I've been worried about that from the first indications that Joe Biden had been deeply, well, compromised, I don't think is the right term for it, captured by the Chinese Communist Party. How can you expect everybody else in the food chain to be as rigorous about protecting classified information and not selling it or otherwise compromising it? Bobby, so this is very, very important insight, I think. And I did want to just mention that in this counterintelligence context, as you may remember, we did a webinar last week about
yes.
this biological warfare laboratory that apparently has been operating in Central California, whether it in fact was manufacturing biological agents is unknown at this moment.
Well, it also had...
It had the capability to do it, that's for sure. And if the Chinese wanted to do that, you can bet they did. They would. And especially if concerned, Bobby, going back to your naval days, just down the road from it is a critically important naval air station that supports essentially the entire carrier fleet with their strike aircraft, the F-18s. So if the purpose had been to put down a biological attack on that facility, it would have been a very serious blow in the context of a possible shooting war. Your thoughts?
You know, Frank, one of the things you're pointing out, and it's just such a critical issue. First of all, people often listen to people like you or me or someone else who's a speaker of truth, as Winston Churchill, I would say, was before the Cold War onset. And they look at us and perhaps think that it's an overstatement that something like this could have happened or might happen. I look at it through a completely different lens, and perhaps I'd encourage others watching to do that. I look at it through the lens of force protection, which is to say, for example, when we have bases around the world, we do not want the food coming from local personnel if those personnel are themselves suspect, because they could infect the entire system. And I'm thinking in particular of a base where aviators were, because you just mentioned the F-18. Yes, the thing that we discovered, or that was discovered according to public reports in that lab in California, run by the Chinese, unbelievably, for which the Chinese government is taking no responsibility, but it's all there. The reality is that there were white mice in there who were infected with COVID, and they had the medical, the biomedical capability to create more of this. And you're absolutely right. If you affect the nursing and doctor crews on, never mind the aviators themselves, you have nobbled our defense. So it's a force protection issue.
It is indeed. Bobby, we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment. I did want to just say that one of the takeaways from all of that is, are there other such facilities run by the Chinese Communist Party in our country, perhaps in proximity to other strategic assets? One of the participants in this program, Dr. Stephen Hatfield, made the point that in the biological weapons business, the freshness of the batch is very important. So proximity to the target, meaning fresh stuff is getting to it, is very, very important. It's a critically important problem for us to be addressing, and I'm not sure we are properly.
I agree.
Bobby, we're going to take just a moment break. We'll be right back with more with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles And we've reached a really critical point. Bobby, you were speaking before the break about the infectious, if I can use that expression in the context of biowarfare, among other things, the infectiousness of corruption at the highest level on those elsewhere in the government or in the military in this case. I wondered if you'd comment sort of more broadly on the impact of having a person of low personal quality, of integrity, of truthfulness, of character on the rest of our country, not just people in government, yeah. not just people in uniform. It seems to me it's hard to overstate the rot that that entails and the damage that it does. Your thoughts?
You're right. You're right, Frank. I mean, to have someone of poor or little character at the very top of the pyramid has both direct and indirect effects. And what you're seeing right now, I mean, just to put a fine point on it, you have a president of the United States who, as vice president, almost certainly sold his office. And the documentary, I mean, thousands of pages now of documentary evidence, bank records that support this. We have witnesses on the Hill, including the former partner of his son. We have both international and domestic sources of intelligence that validate this. And probably, if you really want to know the truth, the NSA has the phone records and knows these facts. But the direct effect, before I get to indirect, is that you have an attorney general of the United States, a director of the FBI, and certainly the head of IRS, if not others, and White House personnel, who are all being compromised. They're all being dragged down the vortex of a cover-up. And this is exactly what happened, except in a much more minor way, with Richard Nixon. You know, the attorney general in that case was John Mitchell, not Merrick Garland, but he served 19 months in prison for covering up. And this is what these people are up against. In terms of the character flow to all of us, look, we all either have kids or we have influences in our lives that we pay attention to. We read about what's going on in the world. We don't like a lot of what we read about, but we do it all the same. And when you see the absence of character in a president of the United States and in the media people who are covering him and in those around him, and you see a combination of bold and knowing defense of bad behavior by congressmen like Mr. Goldman and others, you see at the same time things like silence on the part of all the Democrat senators who themselves surely see and understand the gravity of what he's done, the impeachability and the indictability of what he's done. What it does is it sends a shiver through us all, because it makes us, never mind what it does to kids and their sense of role modeling, but what it does to us is it causes us not to trust our government, Frank. And if we can't trust the government that serves us, we're in trouble.
Yeah. And at the core of that trust, Bobby, as we've talked about previously, is confidence that the sort of social compact between the individual and the government, I think personified or epitomized, maybe it's a better term for it, in the idea of the rule of law, is
that's right.
very much in peril at the moment, because at the same time that there's this covering up going on and essentially get out of jail free cards being issued to members of the what's been called the Biden crime family, you have the prosecution taking place of a former president of the United States, Donald Trump,
that's right.
in ways that I think are increasingly now, especially with this latest indictment, I'd be interested in your thoughts about the one concerning January 6th, that bespeak to the American people not equal justice under the law, but in fact a breach of that fundamental compact. They may well be treated very yeah. differently depending on where they align politically or for other reasons. Your yeah. thoughts?
So, you know, Frank, you can violate rule of law by failing to enforce laws that are on the books against those against which they should be enforced. And so you can fail to prosecute in the case of Biden and his family and those around him. Or you can do the reverse, which is to abuse the laws and prosecute those that, for political reasons, that are your political enemies. And that turns prosecution into persecution. I went all over the world, 70 countries, trying to tell people not to mix politics with the fair administration of justice. And here I come home. And what do we have? We have a president of the United States who, at the very outset, was defending of, and apparently maybe the prior president was too, and the former Secretary of State, defending of lies that would attempt to delegitimize him when he was in office. When he got out of office, they violated the Fourth Amendment, almost certainly going into his home, seeking and finding a few documents, by comparison, ironically, to thousands of pages being held by the current president without protection. And now we turn around and we see Mr. Bragg in New York
bringing in absolute lawless protection or authorization, for that matter.
Or authorization, that's right. And going back to his Senate days, by the way. But we also have now in New York an indictment that is being brought, really a lawless indictment, by a guy who got elected saying that his goal was to find a reason to prosecute the former president from the other party. You then have another New York attorney doing that. You then have this guy, Mr. Jack Smith, who is the only prosecutor on the face of the planet who has been reversed unanimously by the Supreme Court for an abuse of his prosecutorial discretion by prosecuting another Republican politician, Mr. McDonnell, of Governor McDonnell from Virginia. And I read that entire opinion earlier this week, looked at side by side with the latest indictment. He's now brought two indictments, one about classified records, but never mind, we're not going to bring one against the current president for more classified records. And now one based on Trump's exercise of free speech rights as a president of the United States. And, you know, who is this guy, Jack Smith? He's an arch, he's really a hack. He's an arch political prosecutor whose wife created this glowing documentary about Michelle Obama, who has decided, and Merrick Garland knew this going in, who's decided that his target of opportunity, his target of interest is the former president. You know, there comes a moment, Frank, and I'll end with this. There comes a moment when people who are not in favor of somebody favor the underdog. And that's what's happening with Trump.
Well, let's hope so. It's an opportunity for a correction, for sure. And I think the argument we've just been making is a correction is urgently needed in so many ways. Mr. Secretary, thank you for your time today and for your continuing service to our country at the Association of Mature American Citizens, among other places. Come back to us next week if you would. I hope the rest of you do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.